Welcome to Tower Talks with Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast. And now for your weekly recap, a timely review of this week's top headlines and takeaways. Here's your host.
Welcome to Inside Towers Week in Review. I'm Leslie Stimson, Inside Towers Washington Bureau Chief. With me are John Celentano, our business editor, Sharp Smith, our technology editor, and Jim Fryer, our managing editor. This episode is sponsored by Inside Towers Intelligence. It's a quarterly market report that dives deep into the wireless infrastructure ecosystem. Intelligence looks at market trends, capital expenditures, relevant M&A transactions, and more. Intelligence is designed for managers, marketers, and investors. The 2023 Volume 3 issue is available now. An annual subscription also includes an exclusive briefing and online support. For more information or to subscribe, visit insidetowers.com/intelligence. So, John, you had a big week. You went to Nate's conference in Denver. You want to tell us about it?
I did. It was a good trip. It was one of the Nate regional wireless conferences that they've been holding. It's the Nate Wynn Group of Wireless in Networking Group. And so they held it in Denver. It was actually at a top golf facility in the tech center, the tech park outside of Denver. About 100 people attended, primarily the contractors, the tower climbing companies, some vendors, and some industry participants as well. One of the big themes right now for this group is the effects of the spending slowdown and construction activity amongst the mobile carriers. All of these people that participated in this session, do the construction work and the field work, and they've seen a significant slowdown. In fact, one characterized it that the spigot has been turned off completely, but I don't know if that's entirely true across the board, but the level of activity in the field is significantly down from the past couple of years. And we looked at the capital expenditure trend among the carriers, and we anticipated a significant drop off. But I think talking to the folks that actually do the work, they feel it's been turned off completely. And so there's a lot of concern about how long this may persist and how to work through it without, losing people and losing their business, and when we might anticipate an upturn in activity. So there was a number of panels that people were speaking from. The keynote for this session was Richard Latio, who was the Senior Vice President of National Development for Dish Network. But he emphasized that, the fact that Dish adopted a 5G cloud-based Open RAN network architecture allowed them to move quickly to reach that kind of goal. The agreement with Apple they have to distribute the iPhone 15 through Amazon. He believes that this is going to be a significant catalyst to boost subscriptions on Dish's 5G network. So we also had a panel moderated by Craig Snyder of Vicor. They were looking at some of the specific issues that the contractors are dealing with. Even Craig and his own company have gone through some adaptions to the reduced field work. And they looked at a few solutions and how to respond. And the topic of the tower climber unionization came up, but the panel, for the most part, downplayed it. They're not entirely in favor of it. Craig thought that it might be better if tower companies, if not colluded, at least had some agreements that they were going to support each other and not work against each other as a way of sort of ensuring that they're not being lowballed on price or they're not being unduly cut out of potential work. But Unions, the idea of a tower climber union, I think, was generally downplayed. I participated in a session with Pathmal Gunawardana from SBA. We talked about edge data centers in the tower business. We looked at several edge architectures and use cases, and presented a projection that we developed in Inside Towers Intelligence of what the edge data center growth might look like over the next few years. And to this audience, we had flagged, here's some work opportunities associated with edge data centers at tower sites. And we'll walk through that. JP Jones of Safety LMS chaired a panel on the use of power to senders in telecom. And they had reps from Ronin, Skylatech, and Sprat talking about their particular products and how they're used. And then a final session looked at, it was called a communications infrastructure in the digital divide. And it looked at, the potential benefits that BEAD funding might have, but also the fact that, there's still a preference for fiber versus wireless projects. They talked about potential scarcity of spectrum to meet future demand, and also how working with municipalities or tribal groups to deploy broadband infrastructure is takes a bit of effort, but it can be really beneficial to the parties involved. So, good session overall. Thanks to Vicor and Nate for their effort in organizing it and managing what I thought was a pretty productive session.
So Dish Network and the FCC's Enforcement Bureau reached a deal to end the agency's investigation into the company's failure to deorbit its EchoStar 7 satellite. And the commission says this is the first settlement reached with a company over space debris. You know, the FCC is doing more with space right now. They have established the new Space Bureau, focusing more on space policy reforms. In this consent decree, Dish admitted liability. The company will pay a $150,000 fine and adhere to a compliance plan to prevent future occurrences. In exchange, the FCC drops the investigation. So specifically, the investigation found that Dish violated the Communications Act, the FCC's rules, and the terms of its license by moving its direct broadcast satellite service, EchoStar 7 satellite, at the end of the spacecraft's mission to a disposal orbit that was, quote, well below, unquote, the elevation required by the terms of its license. The problem is at the lower altitude, it could interfere with other satellites. In an orbital debris mitigation plan filed by Dish, which was approved by the commission in 2012, the company committed to bringing the satellite at the end of its life to an altitude of approximately 186 miles above its operational geostationary arc. And they had estimated the end of that life would be May 2022. But in February 2022, Dish realized that the satellite had very little propellant left. So it meant it couldn't follow the original orbital debris mitigation plan. They had to retire the satellite at a disposal orbit that was about 75 feet above the geostationary arc, which was well short of where it was supposed to be, which was 106 miles specified in its orbital debris mitigation plan. So, and it was a big deal for Dish, but also because it was the first satellite orbital debris fine the FCC has levied this year, and ever, actually. Another story that was happening was the big nationwide alert that went out, the wireless emergency alert system for phones and the broadcast emergency alert system, EAS, for broadcasters. The WEA alert went out at about 2:18 nationwide Eastern time, and the EAS alert went out about 2 minutes later. And I saw some chatter on broadcast sites that said, oh, the WEA alert went too soon. No, actually, it was supposed to go out 2 minutes before. EAS tests went to over-the-air radio and TV stations, satellite radio, cable systems, and wireline video systems. And they in turn distribute the alert to their listeners and their viewers. FEMA originated the alerts using its IPAWS Common Alerting Protocol technology platform. So the WEA-compatible cell phones were expected to receive the test if they were turned on and near a cell tower. And although the alert was to be active within the cell network for about 30 minutes, each cell phone would only receive the alert once. And of course, it had the traditional text message that said, "This is a test. This is not an actual emergency." And the reason they do this test is to make sure that they can send one nationwide. Because, you know, remember when EAS first started, the idea was if the president needed to reach everybody all at once across the country, and then that morphed into expanding it to cable and satellite radio and eventually cell phones using the wireless emergency alerts. And we don't know how it's all carried out yet, or how it all came about yet, because the carriers and the broadcasters have a few weeks to get their data into the FCC. The data would say when they got, if they got the alert from FEMA, when, and when they were able to retransmit it. So lots to come on that. And then on a personal note, I was able to attend the Society of Broadcast Engineers Chapter 37 picnic this week, which was a lot of fun. And many, many companies were actually displayed their wares there, including Dielectric, Nautel, Digital Alert Systems, ENCO, lots of good folks there. So that's it for me. And I think, Sharp, you're going to tell us about a sustainability tower sighting in Germany, I think.
Yes, I am. We had a little fun with this. My headline was Wooden Cell Tower Takes Root in Germany, or The Black Forest Has Nothing on the Cell Tower Industry. This is the third wooden cell tower that's being developed with a company called Echo Intelligent. And the carrier involved is Vantage Towers. And they're putting up a structure called an Echo Pole, ECOPOL tower. It's 131 feet, and it's manufactured in Finland by a company called Echo Intelligent. And I thought it was interesting, an interesting story on a couple of levels. First of all, wood is a little bit more eco-friendly than steel. And so it has that going for it. The other thing was, if you go to the story on the website, the wooden cell towers are very beautiful. And I think, as far as getting a cell tower approved, if you could build it out of wood, it might go better by the zoning board. It's hard to say, but Christian Hillebrandt, the new CEO of Vantage Towers, his quote was at his company, sustainability and digitalization are not contradictions, but go very much hand in hand. The community had actively sought the construction of a wooden mast. The excellent cooperation and with the municipality is a prime example of how mobile communications rollout in rural areas can succeed. So I think there's going to be a lot of rural towers built in rural areas through the BEAD program. And it'd be interesting if these companies might take a look at something like this.
So, Jim, you had a hard story to work on this week.
Yeah, Leslie, occasionally we have to do our jobs and they're not not easy. And this was certainly fell in that category. A young 32-year-old tower climber named Darren Bishop fell from a tower 2 weeks ago, and he was laid to rest last Sunday. He was working at a 300-foot tower in outside of Cleveland for a company that was working under Black & Veatch was the managing company. And apparently they were just completing, must have just been completing the job because they were taking pictures of their work when he fell. And I got the police report from the county sheriff, which was a tough read because it's a hard thing to for these people to witness. And I think in the future we may want to do a story on sort of the PTSD that has to inevitably be suffered by not just the deputies and the first responders who get there on the site, but the crew members. There were three other crew members with him, one on the tower and two on the ground when he fell. I thought one of the interesting aspects of it was that this county in Ohio, Geauga County, I believe is the name of it, they dispatched a team of counselors who were trained in PTSD and trained in, it was called the LOSS, L-O-S-S, and I'm trying to come up with what the acronym actually stood for, but it's a great acronym because that's what they deal in. And I know the word survivors is part of the one of the S's. But they were dispatched to the site, and I was told that's extremely rare for that to happen, and that sometimes these climbers and the first responders are, you know, left on their own devices to seek counseling for that. So I hope they all got that counseling. The climber, Darren Bishop, was also a photographer, and he had his own photography studio. And I even got on his site to saw some of the beautiful, beautiful photographs that he had taken. So, you know, you realize how tragic it is, the loss of such a young life, a creative young man, but also he had a wife and two young children. So on our obituary that we ran, the story that we ran that came out yesterday morning, Thursday morning, sorry, there are two sites. There's a GoFundMe site, and the Tower Family Foundation does their usual terrific job of putting together funds for families of tower climbers who have been lost or injured on the job. So if nothing else, if you can find that story that we ran last week, it ran on Thursday morning, please check out the funding sites at the bottom of the page. And maybe if you can contribute to helping the family out in that.
Jim, did they have an idea of what caused the fall?
He was still wearing his harness. He was a 9-year veteran of tower climbing, so he wasn't like just a rookie. There was a set of yellow strap found on the ground not far from him. Outside of that, OSHA was there on the scene. American Tower representatives were on the scene very quickly as well. So, you know, we'll have to see in the OSHA report exactly what happened. I don't think anybody witnessed the him falling from the tower. So I don't know if you know how the, you know they'll obviously piece this together, but I'll let the professionals do their job on that, and we'll when we get an OSHA report, we'll report on that.
Well, thank you, Jim. That's a wrap, and thank you all for listening to Inside Towers Week in Review. Just a reminder, for a complete rundown of all the week's stories, check out our Saturday edition. See you in a week.
Thank you for listening to Tower Talks. To subscribe to our podcast, our daily newsletter, or use our other industry resources, please visit InsideTowers.com. Until next time, you've been listening to Tower Talks from Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast.